Wade Davis is the closest anthropology will ever get to a superstar. He's got degrees from Harvard in biology, anthropology, and ethnobotany. He wrote the bestseller, The Serpent and the Rainbow. He's National Geographic's explorer in residence. And as you can imagine, Wade Davis has traveled to the remote reaches of our planet. But it wasn't until recently, with his visit to the Aboriginal people of the Northern Territory of Australia, that he came upon something that really gave him pause. It was the Aboriginal idea of the dreaming, an existence with no linear time. Wade Davis told Steve Paulson that the dreaming is one of the great experiments in human thought.
There was something about the Aboriginal people that deeply offended the British, and of course their conclusion was that, after all, we were once again dealing with savages, and in this case, the lowest of the low. What the British completely failed was to understand the subtlety of the Aboriginal mind. And therefore, they were debating as recently as 1902 in Parliament, in Australia, whether or not Aboriginal people were in fact human beings. In the 1930s and 40s, you could virtually shoot and kill an Aboriginal person, quote-unquote, trespassing on your land with impunity. As recently as the 1960s, a colleague of mine, an anthropologist, said that growing up in South Australia, he had a book in school called A Treasury of Fauna of Australia, which included Aboriginal people in the 1960s as part of the fauna. Now, what was really going on? What was going on was that the British were encountering a whole nother possibility of life itself. The Aboriginal mind embraces reality on two different levels. On the one hand, there's the realm of the phenomenological realm, and there's also the realm of the dreaming. So the world both exists as you see it before your feet, but it is always waiting to be born in the realm of the dreaming.
Just so I understand this, so there's one sense of time that would probably be kind of like our sense of time. I mean, you know, if they're going out to...
No, actually, the amazing thing is in not one of the 300 more languages spoken in Australia is there a word for time.
Really?
There is no word for past, present, or future. And this isn't, incidentally, hippie ethnography. This is just the way they thought.
Wow. But I would think that just in terms of, let's say, if they're going to go out and track and hunt an animal, I mean, clearly there is a sense of linear time there, what you have to do to be
course,
able to bring
down
course. The
animal. And that's a very good point, Stephen, because obviously there's also great capacity for deductive logic. I mean, for example, if you do, as we did, go out with the Aboriginal people on a kangaroo fire drive to hunt animals, they track the animals with a perspicacity and a clear and deductive process of logic that would put Sherlock Holmes to shame. So we're not talking as if these individuals were incapable of thinking, quite to the contrary. And obviously the fundamental rhythms of a day, the sun rising in the morning and setting in the afternoon, the moon coming up, gives you a sort of diurnal sense of the passage of time. But that's not really the point. The real thrust of what was going on is this idea of the dreaming, which is very difficult to define in clear terms, is that if everything in the West was about progress, dreaming is the opposite. The dreaming was all about stasis, constancy, the perfection of the world as it existed in the eternal moment.
So there's something about dreaming that connects you to that origin, to that first moment. You're immediately connected with that past many eons ago.
That's exactly the point, is that there is no sense of separation between the moment in time when the ancestors brought the world into being and all of human activity. The entire thrust of human intellectual and spiritual effort is not to change the world or to change yourself, but to do the complete opposite, to engage your ritual and ceremonial gestures that are deemed to be essential to keep the world exactly as it was at the time of the first dawning. It's as if every single intellectual impulse in the Western philosophical and technological tradition had gone into maintaining the Garden of Eden exactly as it was, each shrub pruned perfectly to replicate the world just as it was when Adam and Eve had that fateful conversation.
So how did people get access to this dream time?
The dream time existed in multi-dimensions at all times. They were part of the dreaming. It wasn't like they had access to the dreaming. It wasn't like it was a hallucinogenic state or a state of altered consciousness. The dreaming is the definition of the unity of the now. The dreaming is everything that ever existed, everything that exists today, and everything that will ever exist. And so you are encased, by definition, in the realm of the dreaming. This was not a civilization without a history. In a way, it was a civilization through their idea system that had, in fact, defeated the very notion of history.
You have called the Dreamtime one of the great experiments in human thought. And I'd love to sort of speculate on what you mean by that. I mean, this was a whole different conception of time, nonlinear time. And I guess it does make you wonder if all of humanity had had this nonlinear sense of time, where would we be today?
Well, it's a good question. We'd be somewhere very different, and we wouldn't be where the people who first reached Australia began. I mean, in our society, certainly since the revelation and then liberation of the Enlightenment and then the triumph of our scientific model and paradigm whereby phenomena couldn't exist if they couldn't be measured, and therefore all issues of myth, metaphor, and mysticism were sort of washed away. I mean, that brought us great precision of thought, but it also brought us kind of a certain isolation in the universe, because for most of human cultures, for most of history, myth and mysticism and some religiosity have sort of defined a blanket of comfort that we insulate ourselves with as conscious individuals. I always find it interesting to pay attention to the metaphors of a culture. So, for example, in the Andes of Peru, everybody is raised in those villages to believe that there is a dominant mountain deity, an Apu spirit that will direct his or her destiny. Now, this is kind of a natural conclusion if you're raised in the Andes in an agricultural civilization where you see the clouds coalesce around the mountains, you see the rain fall to the fields, you know what can happen if frost or hail strikes your harvest and can wipe it out in 15 minutes. There is a natural tendency to view the mountains as a source of both fertility and life and potential danger. So the idea of having this dialogue with a mountain is not as esoteric or obscure as it may sound. But the bottom line is, that makes those children of the high Andes very different than a kid growing up in Wyoming who's been taught implicitly and explicitly that a mountain is simply a pile of rock or coal ready to be mined. There are real consequences to these different belief systems. Now, I'm not saying that I would personally want to live the life of Aboriginal people in Australia before contact. I'm not saying that what they achieved is better or worse than what we achieve. But it is certainly interesting in the sense that, again, had we all followed that track of maintaining the world as it was at the time of the first dawning, yes, we would not have made the scientific, technological inroads that we've made and the great successes that we've accomplished. But we also wouldn't have torn down the ancient forests, we wouldn't have depopulated the fish in the seas, we wouldn't be talking about global climate change affecting life support systems of the planet, and all the other, not hysterical, but demonstrable consequences of a particular set of choices that our technologically oriented civilization chose to do.
Wade Davis is National Geographic's explorer in residence. He's the author of numerous books of fiction and nonfiction, including the bestseller The Serpent and the Rainbow. Steve Paulson spoke with him.